This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be spending some time talking about the mission and the history of the U.S. Coast Guard. You might be surprised to learn that the Coast Guard is, in fact, the smallest of all of America's armed services. It's about the size of the New York City Police Department. It has been involved in every major war this country has fought since the Civil War, but it has a very broad mission, certainly something that goes way beyond combat and includes things like homeland security, but also maritime security and safety. They deal with environmental issues. It's the mandate of the Coast Guard is really quite broad. In this part of the program, we'll be talking with Douglas Kroll. He is assistant professor of history at the College of the Desert, and he has somebody who has broad experience with the Coast Guard. He was a graduate, in fact, of the Coast Guard Academy. That was in 1971. He served as a Coast Guard officer afloat and overseas before he resigned his commission to become a Navy chaplain. He retired in 1996 as a commander in the Naval Reserve. Has a rather interesting background. He has a divinity degree from Luther Theological Seminary, which is in St. Paul, master's degree in history from University of San Diego, and PhD in history from the Claremont Graduate University. He's authored a number of articles dealing with the Coast Guard and also with naval history, and he has taught a number of other places before he went to teach at the College of the Desert, also including Cal Polytechnic University in Pomona and Cal State in Los Angeles. He's been a full-time faculty member at College of the Desert since the fall of 2002, and in his research now, he has been studying the Imperial Russian Navy in San Francisco during the American Civil War. He's also author of a book that is a biography of the first commandant of the Coast Guard, Ellsworth Berthoff, and that was published back in 2002. He's talking with us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WYLL. And toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Kroll, hello.
Hello there, David.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's glad to do that.
And we certainly appreciate it. And I can't get away without at least marking on the irony that we're talking about the Coast Guard with a guy who teaches at the College of the Desert. How exactly did that happen?
Well, I was applying for full-time history teaching jobs, and the College of the Desert, which is out in the Palm Springs area of Southern California, offered me this job, and I accepted it. And I'm teaching U.S. history, which I love to share my passion for our nation's past with my students here, and I bring in maritime history and military history when I'm teaching U.S. history. So I'm glad to be here, and gives me time to do more writing and research as well as teaching all my students.
What was it that when you started thinking about what you would do for a career and where you might go to college that drew you to the Coast Guard and to the Coast Guard Academy?
Well, I grew up in Northwest Illinois in a little town called Lanark, a little farming community up by Galena, Freeport, and Savannah. And I was involved in Boy Scouts and different merit badges. And I have a great uncle who was the mayor of Annapolis, Maryland. We used to go visit him there and visit the Naval Academy, and in reading the Sailing Merit Badge pamphlet many, many years ago, back in the early 60s, I discovered there was the Coast Guard Academy, and it was a non-political appointment. It's the only military academy that has no quotas by congressional district or state. It's just nationwide competition, and I applied for both Annapolis through my congressman and for the Coast Guard Academy, and there were no vacancies at Annapolis, but I earned an appointment to the Coast Guard Academy, so I accepted that, and went off to get my education at the Coast Guard Academy in New London, Connecticut.
You know, I think that on this program over the years, I'm sure that we've talked about a number of subjects that one way or another have to do with the defense and with the military. And having said that, I can't ever remember really spending very much time talking about the Coast Guard. And I think there are a lot of very interesting things about it and its history. And I ask this question knowing full well the kind of answer that I expect. But here is the question. Do you think that the Coast Guard is underappreciated?
I think it's underappreciated by many people that do the funding in Congress and by much of the general public. They sometimes don't even realize it's an armed force. They sometimes think it's just a uniform service, you know, like the Border Patrol or the Forest Service. And so the people that live near the water on the coastline or along the Great Lakes or along the Mississippi River where there's a Coast Guard presence appreciate it very much, but the rest of the country probably doesn't appreciate it as much because it's more unknown than the other armed forces are.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that people who are either, as you say, live on the coast or somehow are involved in some kind of maritime enterprise certainly are familiar with the Coast Guard and its mission of rescue. They do a very important job of trying to help people who are in trouble in the waters, and not just coastal waters, but also inland waterways, too.
That's correct. The search and rescue mission has the most visibility of the Coast Guard missions and probably the most appreciation for that mission.
Is it possible to say, if you take a look, for example, at the budget of the Coast Guard and how much money is spent and make some comparisons between that and the other armed services, if you take a look at how much we spend on the Coast Guard, say, per person, that is, per member of the Coast Guard, or you try to make some kind of assessment of looking at the various functions of the Coast Guard, is there any way to make some sort of assessment and say what we get for our money, what we spend on it, as compared to other armed services, or is the scale so out of whack between the two that you couldn't even make a kind of an assessment like that?
Well, the assessment I would make is that the Department of Defense Armed Forces seem to get more proportional funding for equipment, for ships and planes and tanks, and the Coast Guard has always been sort of making do with what they had, probably has the oldest ships and airplanes and funding, and every time the Coast Guard went under the Department of the Navy, through all the nation's wars, even before the Civil War, they got more funding when they were under the Department of Navy than they did when they were either earlier under the Department of Treasury or then the Department of Transportation. So one of the hopeful things is now being the Department of Homeland Security, the Coast Guard might be more visible and might get more funding now than it's gotten in the past. Hmm. I wouldn't know the comparison per person, but just in terms of equipment and support, I'm sure the Department of Defense Armed Forces probably get much more support financially than the Coast Guard does. It does a lot of different things, and it just does with what it has, and sometimes the leadership of the Coast Guard hasn't been, I think, assertive enough in the past to tell the congressional funders that we need more money to do what we're tasked to do, because the Coast Guard gets more tasks over as the years pass. But sometimes that isn't funded adequately, but the Coast Guard still does the best job it can with what funding it has.
You touched on something I think is interesting, and I did not know, who would not have thought about, and that is, while it is true that during wartime, the Coast Guard has been pulled into the Navy, it becomes part of the Navy. Part of the Department of the Navy.
Right, like the Marine Corps is the Department of the Navy, so it comes under the Department of the Navy,
okay.
Right?
Really the rest of the time, and most of the rest of its history, the Coast Guard has been outside of the military. It has never been based in the Pentagon, and in fact, as you say, it started out being part of the Treasury Department, and then it was for a long time, and then it was part of the Transportation Department, and now comes under Homeland Security. It's never really been part of the sort of main defense establishment of the United States.
That's one of the problems I think the Coast Guard has. Since its official founding in 1915, and the legislation says it is at all times an armed force of the United States, since it's not part of the same department as the other armed forces, that's why people don't often think of it as an armed force, because it's not in under the Pentagon normally or under the Department of Defense. And so that's why they think of it as a uniform service rather than a military service. So I always thought of it, even when I was in it, as a forgotten armed force. And I joined it during Vietnam, and most people didn't know there was a higher percentage of Coast Guard people in Vietnam than any other armed force. I mean, it's a small service, but this percentage of its personnel, there were higher percentage of Coast Guard people serving in Vietnam than any other armed force, and most people didn't even know the Coast Guard was over there doing a variety of things.
Yeah, the Coast Guard has been involved in the Gulf, in both Gulf Wars.
That's right, and there's right now in the Persian Gulf, there's a high-endurance cutter with a Coast Guard helicopter detachment on it and port security people. It's involved in both Gulf War One and over there in Operation Iraqi Freedom. It's present there. A lot of people aren't aware of that. There's already been one Coast Guardman that was killed in combat in the Persian Gulf. A damage controlman who was doing security, protecting an offshore oil platform, when a suicide boat, they were intercepting a suicide boat, and he and the Navy people with him lost their lives combating the terrorist over there in the Persian Gulf.
Is it true that I have this corrected, that the Coast Guard predates the U.S. Navy?
Yes, what it was. When the American Revolution ended, there was no more Navy anymore. There was no Navy when the country came into being under the Constitution. And then when it started, one of the problems was there was no Navy. They didn't, or a standing Navy or even an Army at that point in time. But the nation was almost bankrupt of all the debts from the American Revolution. And so the Secretary of the Treasury, the first one, Alexander Hamilton, was tasked with raising funds, and the biggest source of funds for the early federal government were tariffs, import taxes. And so during the British colonial period, of course, the American colonists were very proud of smuggling things to avoid paying taxes to the British. So to prevent that smuggling, Alexander Hamilton got permission from Congress to create a fleet of 10 cutters to patrol the coast to prevent smuggling, to avoid paying the taxes. So that was 1790 when the Coast Guard, or the Revenue Cutter Service, as it later became known, which is the predecessor of the Coast Guard, was formed. And the U.S. Navy wasn't formed until 1798, although there was a Continental Navy, but the U.S. Navy wasn't formed until 1798. So the Coast Guard has always proudly called itself the oldest continuous seagoing service. The continuous is important in there because there was that period when there wasn't a Navy from 1780 to 1798.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm curious as to why it is that somehow, somewhere along the way, the Coast Guard was not absorbed by the Navy.
There have been a number of attempts to do that throughout its history. The Revenue Cutter Service was sometimes they were going to split it up and everything else. And the biggest attempt for that was at the end of World War One. During World War One, the Coast Guard became a part of the Department of the Navy, and it had a lot of problems in that sort of melding of that. And when the war ended, the Secretary of the Navy and also the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, whose name was Franklin Roosevelt, later president, wanted to keep the Coast Guard permanently in the Navy, and a lot of the Coast Guard personnel actually wanted that to be that way. Because the Navy had better pay, better promotion, better opportunities, and some of the people in the Coast Guard at the time, this is in 1918, 1919, just wanted the Coast Guard just absorbed into the U.S. Navy. Other people at the time wanted it to be a separate service in the Department of the Navy, having the same status as the Marine Corps, which is a separate armed force, but also in the Department of the Navy. But it's commonplace at the time. Ellsworth Bertoff, the man I was the biographer of, argued successfully if that happened, then the Coast Guard's many of its missions would probably not be done anymore, because once it was absorbed in the Navy wouldn't be doing all these non-defense things like search and rescue and merchant marine regulation and boating safety and fisheries regulation and all those other things that were going on. So that's that move has been made a couple of times. Probably the biggest time was there. And then in the 1930s, when during the Great Depression, when Franklin Roosevelt was president, he still had that feeling he wanted the Coast Guard absorbed in the Navy. He tried to do that again, but again, the Coast Guard people managed to get enough support in Congress to prevent that from happening. But the argument's often been made for efficiency or other reasons. Why do we have two separate navies? And the Coast Guard, I think even when I was in it, and although I left the Coast Guard, I always like to say the Coast Guard's never left me. Mm-hmm. The Coast Guard always is sort of proud of that it has an identity that it's more than an armed force. It's an armed force and more, I think it once marketed itself as. So it is an armed force at all times, but it also has a very important mission in peacetime. Whereas the other armed forces, very important for national defense, in peacetime, their main job is just being prepared for war or being a deterrent for war, where the Coast Guard has a very full-time job, even when the nation's not at war.
Well, it also interests me how it is that somewhere along the line, someone didn't say that, make the observation that no other no other armed service or no other uniformed service that the country has a mission so broad. And it surprises me that someone along the lines didn't say, well, look, this is just too much. We're tasking these people with too much. And why don't we say if we're concerned about coastal security and rescue, and also Coast Guard eventually along the way picked up things like responsibility for lighthouses and responsibility for rescuing people that were wrecked off the coast.
Right.
And that also they have these other things they're responsible for things like boating safety, and they're also involved in environmental quality issues. And somewhere along the line did somebody say, well, why don't we strip off the things that have to do with defense and policing maybe? And say we'll give those someplace else, and give the Coast Guard a purely non-military kind of mission. I mean, did anybody ever look at it and say, how what are we doing, giving this one group of people, this one service branch, all of this incredibly wide range of tasks and responsibility?
I'm aware that in the early 1900s, before the Coast Guard was formed by the merger of the Life Saving Service and the Revenue Cutter Service, there was a movement to split up the Revenue Cutter Service, which had all these missions, and parcel them out to either other government agencies. And the argument was made at the time that if they were parceled out, they probably wouldn't be done as well. But one of both the strengths and, I think, weakness of the Coast Guard is that as the decades have passed, they've added other missions to it. And one of the things you mentioned, like in 1939, they merged the Lighthouse Service with the Coast Guard. And then in the 1940s, they brought in the Bureau of Steamboat Inspection or Marine Inspection. So they've added these other things to it. And that's always been a challenge, because even when the Coast Guard was formed in 1915, you merged the Revenue Cutter Service, which was in many respects a military service, with the Civilian Life-Saving Service. And that was really a challenge to meld together civilians into a military organization. Same thing happened in 1939 when they took the Civilian Lighthouse Service and merged it into the military Coast Guard. And then again in the 1940s when they brought in the Steamboat Inspection Service for merchant marine regulation and merged that into it. And when that's happened, I think it's a strength of the Coast Guard, its flexibility, but it's also one of its weaknesses that it's so diverse, it's hard to have a clear identity of just how can you describe what the Coast Guard does? You need almost a couple of pages to do that. Mm-hmm. And it also is a weakness that and I always thought there was sort of a lack of cohesive identity within the Coast Guard, because there are so many people doing so many wide variety of things. The people doing the search and rescue have a very clear identity. They're the lifesavers, and they're, you know, very much in the public eye. But the people doing more of the regulatory things, such as the boating safety or the merchant marine regulation, or the environmental things, don't see themselves maybe in the same way as the search and rescue people do, and then the people who are involved in the more military things like port security and patrolling the ports and in wartime and peacetime, that's a problem. But my sense has always been the Coast Guard has always been very proud of being an armed force, serving in every war, from the quasi-war with France and War of 1812, and then the war with Mexico, the Civil War, World War One, World War Two, and a lot of people think, like in World War Two, all the Coast Guard did was patrol the coasts of the United States. Same thing in World War One, when in fact in World War One the Coast Guard had ships across the Atlantic, off of Gibraltar, off of Great Britain, and was serving in combat and had a higher percentage of casualties in World War One than any armed force. At least one of its ships was sunk by German submarines in World War One. So the Coast Guard, at least in my experience, is very proud of being an armed force and would not want to give that up. That's a part of, at least from my experience, was a part of my prime identity, although I can't speak for all people in the Coast Guard, and yet are proud of being an armed force and more. That we also, I remember one of the things I learned as a cadet is, as a Coast Guard officer, I serve my country and humanity. That it's sort of a humanitarian service and a military service at the same time. And although that creates some maybe tension or lack of identity at times, it's also something to be very proud of.
Let me take a moment here to introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Douglas Kroll. He is Assistant Professor of History at the College of the Desert, which is in Palm Desert, California. He is the author of a number of articles dealing with the Coast Guard and with naval history. He served in the Coast Guard. He was a graduate of the Coast Guard Academy, served as a Coast Guard officer afloat, and then resigned his commission and became a Navy chaplain, retiring in 1996 as a commander in the Naval Reserve, and has then gone on to have an academic career and to teach history. He's the author of a biography of the first commandant of the Coast Guard, and is talking with us this morning by telephone, and questions are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, and here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Is it still the case that for lighthouses, those that are still commissioned, that are officially functioning as lighthouses, the Coast Guard is still responsible for them?
Yes, the Coast Guard is responsible for all aids to navigation, which would include lighthouses, although they were all automated in the 1970s. So there's not any lighthouse keepers, except for the oldest lighthouse up in Boston, I think might have a keeper assigned there. But the Coast Guard is responsible for all the operating lighthouses, as it has been since 1939. So that comes into the Coast Guard as well as a lot of other missions.
We've been talking a little bit about just how broad the mission of the Coast Guard is and how many different jobs have been assigned to the Coast Guard. And also about the fact that I think some people at least would argue that given all of those missions, that it's underfunded. And you said that there always has been this tradition in the Coast Guard of making do with what you're doing, the job that you're supposed to do, and doing it with the resources that you're given. So they may well be understaffed, underfunded. They don't always get state-of-the-art equipment, have this broad range of jobs that they've been given. And having said all that, it seems, at least to me, to be that most people would say that the Coast Guard does a pretty good job of all of these kinds of things. What is it, do you think, about the Coast Guard? Is it something about the people? Is it something about the way that it's structured would tend to make it such a, given the challenges that it has, an agency that seems to, an armed force that seems to operate very effectively?
I think it's the people. There have been some really wonderful, dedicated people serving in the Coast Guard and its predecessor agencies. And unfortunately, the Coast Guard, somewhat like the Navy, has forgotten its heroes and its history. They hardly teach any history at Coast Guard boot camp or at the Coast Guard Academy. But there's been some great heroes. One of the greatest heroes I know that was a Coast Guard helicopter pilot flying in Vietnam. He was in an exchange program with the Air Force out of Da Nang Air Base, and he was doing combat search and rescue, which is to me the two Coast Guard missions all in one. And in trying to rescue a downed Marine pilot, his helicopter was shot down. He was listed as missing in action, and later he was declared killed in action. His remains have recently recovered. But that to me is the epitome of the Coast Guard. These are dedicated people willing to serve, whether in war or peace, willing to risk their lives to rescue other people. And countless people in the life-saving service and then later the Coast Guard have risked their lives and sometimes lost their lives trying to rescue people in distress, whether it be in wartime or peacetime, to do that. And those people have really made the Coast Guard what it is, although unfortunately, many of them have been sort of forgotten, and that's one of my tasks, I think, when the articles I write in that first book is to try to let the Coast Guard people, as well as people outside the Coast Guard, know about some of the great people that have gone before them and served and really made the Coast Guard what it is, given the legacy that it has. And I think that's really more the people than its organization. They've sometimes done a great job in spite of the organization at different times.
Mm-hmm. I think it may be one of the things that strikes me about the Coast Guard is the fact that when the people in the Coast Guard are out there doing their jobs, they do this in relatively small groups and sometimes in very difficult and changing circumstances where they can't ask someone higher up the chain what it is they're supposed to do. They just have to do it. And that seems to create a spirit of at least willingness to do autonomous action, and that maybe in difficult and emergency situations that actually ends up being more effective. I'm sure mistakes get made, but more effective because people say, well, I can't take the time now to ask what I'm supposed to do here. I'm just going to try to figure out what the best thing to do is and do it. Do you think that's the case?
That's very often the case. You've got small boats out there rescuing people. I'm very proud. My younger son is in the Coast Guard now, and he's a helicopter crew member out of San Francisco Air Station. And Coast Guard units tend to be very small units, whether it's a small boat station, whether it's a Coast Guard air station. Even the ships are small compared to Navy size. And as a result, Coast Guard people end up have to take more responsibility, be more trained, and be able to react in an emergency situation. And I think you were very accurate there that they don't have other people they can call on. They have to be a small team and work in sometimes trying situations to make the best of the situation. And that's one of the things I think distinguishes. When I was a Navy chaplain, the first ship I was on had over 1,600 people on the ship, a large Navy ship. And then the Coast Guard, most of their commands have, less than 100 people. Even an air station would have less than 100 people, or you might have a small boat station with only 15 or 20 people. So the smallness gives those people a lot of responsibility. It also gives them a lot of leadership at a very young age and early in their careers.
We talked. One of the things we talked about, the fact that over most of the history of the Coast Guard, it's been under different non-military agencies or parts of the government. That for a long time it was part of the Department of the Treasury, and then it became part of the Department of Transportation, and now just recently, fairly recently, I think this was in spring of 2003. It went from the Transportation Department to the Department of Homeland Security. And in fact, I guess at some point, the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Rumsfeld, suggested maybe that all of the military responsibilities of the Coast Guard should be given to the Navy, and that the Coast Guard should be full-time doing homeland defense stuff. And we've talked about the fact that over time people have made various kinds of proposals about maybe simplifying the mission of the Coast Guard and saying, well, it's doing too many different things, and particularly splitting off the more military stuff. Has the movement of the Coast Guard into the Department of Homeland Security changed the way the Coast Guard works or what the Coast Guard is doing?
I think it's given it, in 1967, when they moved it to the Transportation Department, that's when they formed the Department of Transportation, and then they wanted to create this new department, so they're looking for agencies to put in it, and that sort of emphasized its sort of regulatory function, which I think confused the Coast Guard identity, but a lot of Coast Guard people at the time were happy, hoping they'd get more visibility and more funding, because in the Department of Treasury, the Coast Guard was a smaller agency, and in transportation, it was a little bit bigger. But the FAA was also in there, and the Federal Railroad Commission. And when it went to the Department of Homeland Security, the Coast Guard is now a major agency, probably one of the lead agencies of that new cabinet department. So I think that's helping the Coast Guard, will hopefully help it with visibility, with funding and better support. It also is highlighting more its military identity, which I think got forgotten or gets overlooked a lot, and was almost encouraged when they transferred it to the Department of Transportation. So, and when Rumsfeld made that proposal, I know a lot of I guess I'm a former Coast Guardsman, but a lot of people in the Coast Guard were not happy with his suggestion. I mean, it's understandable why he would say that, but a lot of the push to bring the Coast Guard into the Department of Defense, at least in earlier years, in the 20s and in the 30s and after World War I, was an attempt to, at least from some of the Coast Guard perspective, at least historical perspective, was an attempt to sort of raid the Coast Guard to get its assets to to go into in a Department of Defense situations. The argument that was made has been made over the decades is that why do we need more than one Navy? And the argument is, well, the Coast Guard is not a second Navy. It's a separate branch of the armed forces. That argument could have been used against the Marine Corps. Why do we need a second Army? And the Marines have successfully staked out that they're not the Army. They're another type of land force. And the Coast Guard, I don't think, has been quite as successful as the Marine Corps is staking out over the decades that it is a seagoing service, but it's distinct and different from the Navy. And the Marines have been very successful in not being absorbed into the Army, and that movement was made earlier in U.S. history, and that's been that issue's been closed now. But the Coast has never died with the Coast Guard, and I think part of that is the Coast Guard has not been successful in convincing the public and congressional leaders nearly as successful as the Marine Corps of its identity and its value as not a second Navy or a little Navy, but as a separate armed force.
Has the move into Homeland Security and this talk of maybe putting more emphasis on that kind of part of the mission, has that taken away any of the emphasis from all of the other stuff like rescue and boating safety and safety on the waterways and concerns about maritime environmental issues and so forth? All of those things that don't have anything to do with, at least not directly, don't have anything to do with military issues.
With Homeland Security, I don't think it's taken away much. In fact, one of the things this transfer has done very big improvement. What the Coast Guard has been doing recently, started it in 2004, is create what they call sector commands. And to me, that's a very good way to go. Prior to 2004 and for decades, say in a major metropolitan area, say New York City or Boston or San Francisco or Los Angeles, there would be a number of Coast Guard commands, like a Marine Inspection Office, a Port Security Office, small boat station, an air station, all those different areas there, and they'd all be sort of under a separate command. There wouldn't be anyone in that area overseeing all the Coast Guard personnel. And with the emphasis now on Homeland Security, both for whether it be a natural disaster like the Hurricane Katrina or a terrorist attack, now what the Coast Guard is doing, and I think it's very helpful for the future, is now there's one overall commander for all the Coast Guard personnel, say in Boston or New York or Chesapeake Bay or San Francisco. So if there's any kind of a problem, whether it be a search and rescue problem, Homeland Security problem, a pollution problem, now there's one person that can coordinate everything and that everybody makes things work a lot better. And I see that as one of the improvements that's come with the transfer to the Department of Homeland Security.
When you look at the Coast Guard and its performance, and you have to admire at least its ability to be flexible, the kind of initiative that individual officers, particular places, can take or are allowed to take. We talked about a little bit earlier that might have something to do with the fact that generally they work in small groups and sometimes they deal with emergencies and they just have to do what they have to do without first asking somebody else what it is they have to do. Does that come with it being a smaller organization? And if it was any bigger, whether they could do that? I mean, some of those things that you have to applaud them for their flexibility and their ability to get the job done, a lot of different kinds of jobs done, whether they could do it if actually they were bigger?
Well, I think they could do it if they were bigger, but they would still be, although the entire Coast Guard would be bigger, a lot of the Coast Guard units would be relatively small because that's how the Coast Guard does many of its task in through small units. If you're patrolling a harbor, you don't need as big a units as you would be if you're patrolling the Pacific Ocean or the Atlantic Ocean, or if you're doing primarily search and rescue and law enforcement patrols, say by air, you don't need a huge air station. You need a relatively smaller station. You need an air station there, but you don't need 50 or 60 helicopters to be patrolling the San Francisco area, for example. Looking for pollution, looking for law enforcement, looking for Homeland Security. So even though the Coast Guard were bigger, I think it would still be functioning in smaller units. It wouldn't have the big units like you might find in the Department of Defense Services, where you have a regiment, or you have an aircraft carrier, or a cruiser, or a battalion, or something like that.
According to the figure that I came across, and I'm hoping this is true, or at least pretty close, that there are 39,400 active duty personnel in the Coast Guard now.
Does that sound about right? I think.
Okay. So that does anybody think, you know, as people in the people sitting around talking about the Coast Guard and what kind of resources that it would be nice to have? Does anybody say, well, maybe it would be great if we had 60,000, or if we had 50,000, or do people think and talk in those kinds of terms?
I haven't heard too much about that, about it getting that much bigger. The concern has been not so much about more people as just better equipment. The concern is more about aging aircraft and aging vessels. There are still vessels built in the 1940s the Coast Guard is using, and aircraft that are getting older and older. And so there's more concern with getting better equipment that the people can use. I haven't heard much in my talks and investigation of a push to expand the size in terms of personnel of the Coast Guard. It needs to get bigger. I think every time, that's one of the problems too, is every time the Coast Guard has been given another mission to do, they haven't always given it additional people or additional equipment to do that task, that mission.
Hmm. So what sort of, I'm sure that there are people in Washington who would be arguing for greater resources, particularly for modernization of equipment for the ships, the planes and the helicopters that the Coast Guard uses. Is there somebody in Washington who particularly is known as a important advocate for the Coast Guard?
Well, I'm sure it's Commandant that goes and testifies to do that. And then the U.S. Navy League works for all the sea services, for the Navy, the Marine Corps, and the Coast Guard. So the Navy League would be working to do that. And there are a number of, I'm sure, congressional leaders from states that have, like we talked earlier, that are on the sea coast or the Great Lakes or Alaska, that where the Coast Guard has a vital presence, that would be supporters of them. But as I said earlier, there's never been a sense of, it doesn't have nearly as much support, for example, in terms of numbers and influence that the other armed forces do. And that's, I suppose, due to nothing else because it's small size. As you mentioned in the beginning of this program, the New York City Police Department is about the same size as the Coast Guard. So it, in the world terms, the Coast Guard's a very large Navy. But in terms of the United States, if you compare it to the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, the Coast Guard is very tiny. And so in relatively speaking, it's sort of small, and I think that has affected it too.
We have a couple of callers here we'll get to. Let me take the opportunity here to introduce once again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in. We're talking with Douglas Kroll. He is Assistant Professor of History at the College of the Desert, which is in Palm Desert, California. He's also taught at a number of other educational institutions in California. He is the author of many articles dealing with the Coast Guard and with naval history. He is a former Coast Guard member. He graduated from the Coast Guard Academy. He served as a Coast Guard officer afloat and overseas before resigning his commission to become a Navy chaplain. He retired in 1996 as a commander in the Naval Reserve. He has a Master of Divinity degree from Luther Theological Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota, and got his PhD at Claremont Graduate University, and is talking with us this morning by telephone, talking about the Coast Guard. We have a couple of people here to bring into the conversation. Others who are listening are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. First is a caller in Urbana, and that's line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the New York Fire Department and anticipated my question a bit. The military forces are there to make war on some scale, and that's a very different. We hardly need to say that's a very different kind of encounter with a civil population or a military opponent. The Coast Guard, is it useful to talk about the Coast Guard in terms of the fire rescue police maritime services of some large cities like New York? It struck me listening to you that the Coast Guard interconnection or the relationship to Americans at large is apt to be helpful, friendly, functional in the same way that, as I said, those maritime divisions of a large city's municipal services. I don't know if this is a useful comparison or not. I'll listen off the air.
What do you think about that?
I think that's a good point there, that that's the humanitarian part of the Coast Guard, and it's involved with rescue, and it is in that sense similar to a large metropolitan maritime. A lot of maritime fire departments have boats that fight fires on the piers, and some ship have their own lifeguards and search and rescue, and the Coast Guard is that's one of the strengths of the Coast Guard, and a lot of people join the Coast Guard for that exact reason. They want to serve humanity. They want to help people, and they do that on federal waters or interstate waters, whereas the municipal things would just do that in a harbor, where in the Coast Guard you could be doing that overseas. You could be doing it on the coastline, on the Great Lakes, in Alaska, Hawaii, anywhere in the world, even in not so much in the Persian Gulf. We're not doing search and rescue there, but there's a comparison there that the Coast Guard is very much a humanitarian service like those civilian agencies. But it's more than that. It's also, when necessary, it can be involved in, for example, Homeland Security with law enforcement. The Coast Guard was exempted from the very when they passed that legislation, Posse Comitatus, which kept the armed forces from any law enforcement role in U.S. society. And the National Guard has been exempted from that, as was the Coast Guard, because it's always been the federal maritime law enforcement on the water, where the Navy has never had that responsibility. And even in the Persian Gulf, the Coast Guard had law enforcement detachments. They were the people that had the expertise and the authority to board foreign merchant ships in the high seas. The Navy would take them over there in the boats, then the Coast Guard people would provide that expertise there. I'm not sure if I've answered that or responded completely, but that's the thoughts that came to my mind.
All right. Well, let's talk with someone else. This is a Champagne listener, and it's line two. Hello.
Well, you answered one of my questions. The Coast Guard is not subject to the Posse Comitatus Act, which really distinguishes it from the other armed forces. My next question is, to what degree, if you know, has the Coast Guard's mission been affected by the reorganization, putting it into the Homeland Security Department? I know FEMA seemingly has suffered a decline in effectiveness. What about the Coast Guard?
I think the Coast Guard has improved from going from Transportation Department to Homeland Security. It's seen as a more vital armed force in its name, Coast Guard, which is always somewhat misleading because it does a lot more than guard the coast. But people see the Coast Guard. It's always had a presence on the coastline and the harbors, and I think that's strengthened the Coast Guard image. It's improved with the public, and it demonstrated that in Hurricane Katrina, whereas FEMA does not have a very good public relations thing. After FEMA, the Coast Guard came through with flying colors, being on the scene within hours of the hurricane, hitting that area, pulling people with rescue swimmers and raising them up with helicopter rescues.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the transfer to Homeland Security has been a real asset to the Coast Guard, and it's in a much better position today than it was, say, 5 or 6 years ago before Homeland Security was even a department.
One last question, and I don't even know if this organization still exists, but I remember someone telling me once they belonged or an ancestor of theirs was a member of the Merchant Marines. Do you know if that's still a part of our armed forces, and how does that differ from the Coast Guard?
That only affects to World War II. The World War II Merchant Mariners, who were sailing in that combat. Congress, a number of years ago, passed legislation that said World War II merchant mariners would have veteran status.
Okay.
And so merchant mariners that served during World War II have veteran status, as do people that served in the Marine Corps, the Navy, the Army, and the Coast Guard. But that's only the World War II merchant mariners that have that status.
Okay. Well, thank you, sir.
All right.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you for your call.
Other questions are certainly welcome. We have a few minutes left. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Again, just as we have said, people should keep in mind that the Coast Guard is indeed an armed force, although it's the smallest one. It has fought in every major war since the Civil War.
Even before, it served valiantly in the War of 1812. In the quasi war with France and other wars before the Civil War as well.
So it has indeed this military function and status, although people probably will think more about other parts of the mission, and that is how if they have any contact with the Coast Guard, it will be in those ways. Things that we have talked about, like search and rescue and recreational boating safety and port security and drug interdiction, and also things like education around issues of marine pollution and so forth.
Right, ice breaking and AIDS navigation, all those things.
So
right?
all those things have been a big part of the mission. I'm thinking about the fact that, say, since the end of the Cold War, there has been a lot of conversation within defense circles and people who study defense about the mission of the U.S. military and what kind of forces we need and how they should be spending their time. And I suppose that's, again, been maybe since September 11th of 2001, that has been refined again. But I think that there is this expectation that military forces will be increasingly involved in, or it's likely they'll be increasingly involved in, non-military activities, things like peacekeeping, for example, or the kinds of things that American soldiers are trying to do in Iraq in terms of rebuilding the country, all those things that don't involve blowing stuff up. Do you think that in fact the Coast Guard can provide some kind of a model for the other armed forces that are being put into this position of doing other kinds of jobs that are not military, or at least that are not war fighting?
I think they could learn from the Coast Guard, and I think part of that, when you were talking about that, it reminded me of the comments that Secretary Rumsfeld made a little while ago, is the Coast Guard has a very obvious mission in the war against terror and terrorism, because it's always done port security and patrolling the coast, and that the other armed forces have been, in some respects, scrambling for a mission, because the Cold War is over, and, for example, Navy submarines, and I served with them as a chaplain, are now reformatting themselves for intelligence gathering and even launching small, like, commando groups to fight terrorists. And in that sense, the other forces are having to become more diverse, more flexible, because of the new situation we find them in. And I think you're right, they can learn a lot from the Coast Guard, which throughout its history has functioned in a very diverse way while still maintaining its identity and still being an armed force at the same time.
Hmm. I'm just curious here to have you talk just at least for a minute or two, because that's the time that we have, about how it is that the job of the military chaplain has changed over time, and particularly now, since there seems to be such concern about respecting all people's religious faith and people who don't have religious faith, do you think that, in fact, it's now more difficult to be a military chaplain than it has been in the past?
The one thing I think the chaplains have always, they've always been the task to minister to the people of their own faith and provide that the religious needs of others are met. But I think with the growing secularism of our society and this, what I think is a mistaken interpretation of separation of church and state, it is getting more difficult for chaplains to function, especially in the public sphere, of trying to be faithful to their faith as well as meeting the needs of others. And I think that is making it more difficult. And in a way, I'm glad I'm retired now, because that situation, I didn't have to face that when I was in the Navy.
So you wouldn't want to go back. You wouldn't want to go back and be a chaplain today.
Well, I have a military disability from my time in the service with a lung condition. So I don't think I'd be qualified medically for that. But I'm not sure. It would just be a challenge. I admire the people that are serving as chaplains today, but they're facing some challenges because of the growing secularism of our society that maybe makes their job a little more difficult.
Well, I think we're going to have to finish because we've here come to the end of the time. The guest with us part of Focus 580 is Douglas Kroll. He is Assistant Professor of History at the College of the Desert, which is in Palm Desert, California. He's the author of many articles that deal with the history of the Coast Guard and also more generally with naval history. He served in the Coast Guard. He graduated from the Coast Guard Academy, served as Coast Guard officer afloat and overseas before resigning his commission to become a Navy chaplain. And Professor Kroll, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you. I just want to add one more thing.
Oh, sure.
The Coast Guard's motto, Semper Paratus, is always ready, and the Coast Guard has been always ready to answer any call for any mission it's ever been given. So I'm very proud of that mission and proud of the Coast Guard and glad I served in it.
All right. Well, again, thanks very much for talking
okay,
with us.
Okay, thank you.
Programming here on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. Tomorrow morning here on Focus 580, we will reach into the archives and pull out a couple of programs from earlier this year, just recently. In fact, one that has a maritime connection. You'll hear have another opportunity to hear a conversation I had with Michael Schumacher about the Edmund Fitzgerald, a famous oar boat that sank not all that long ago. He's written a book about this. You probably know about it from the song. People just marked the anniversary of that last month. And then going back to last April, a conversation with Mitchell Zukoff. He's a professor of journalism at Boston University who wrote a book about a man who is probably the most famous con man in the history of America. Ponzi was his name. And the book is titled Ponzi's Schemes, The True Story of a Financial Legend. That was from back in April, early this year. That's what we'll be doing tomorrow here on the program. We're here ordinarily weekday mornings, 10 to noon, with 10 different topics every week, and always welcome your questions and comments. Right now, we hope that you will stay tuned because coming up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll rebroadcast an interview with writer John Katz. His latest book is Cats on Dogs. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. March Kansas wheat